Thank you for joining us for this conversation with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. I'm Catherine Loper, news director here at WRVO. Ken, welcome to WRVO.
Thank you, Catherine.
We're thrilled to have you both here in the studio this afternoon and tonight. You'll be at Syracuse Stage, where you will appear with host Grant Reher. And I just want to mention to listeners that there are still tickets available at the door tonight for that event.
So you're saying it's not sold out yet?
Not quite yet.
Well,
so
I think with a star performance like this, I thought people would be lining up to buy these tickets.
I think they will be tonight. Okay. Speaking of star performances, before we dive into the topic of election year politics, I just wanted to start by asking you a few questions about you, because many of our listeners are have heard you regularly on NPR for years, and that's made them want to find out a little bit more about you. So, you know, there's a lot of political reporters out there and a lot in D.C., but few are quite so steeped in the trivia and the minutia of politics. How did you get there?
Well, I love it. I mean, I've always loved it. I've always loved the history. I've always loved the lore. I've always loved the stories. And I think, you know, when you grow up and you're a baseball fan, you remember every World Series and every statistic, you know, from 1066 on. It's like that with politics, too. But having spent 8 years at ABC News and all more than 20 years at NPR, having the opportunity to travel around the country, talk to people, what concerns them, what fears they have, what desires they have about government, things like that, it's not only the history of politics and campaigns, but it's also what people expect from their government. So the combination of that has really led me to where I am today.
Do you have sort of an encyclopedic memory? I mean, your trivia knowledge is just vast.
I don't forget anything, Susan. But, I'm sorry, Catherine. I'm sorry. No, but I think it's not a memorization thing. It's really like I remember the campaigns I've, you know, studied, I've followed. I collect campaign buttons, and that helps too. So sometimes you could visualize the campaigns by looking at some of the great items from previous campaigns. But it's a true passion. And as much as I enjoy talking about it, I've never been cynical. I don't think I'm snarky. I can have fun with it, but I really, really, it really means a lot to me, and I care deeply about the process.
Well, I think one of the reasons why listeners are drawn to you is because you do have an approach that's a little bit, you know, lighthearted with politics. And tell me about your approach to how you cover these issues.
Well, look, I don't diminish the importance of what's going on here. I don't diminish the life and death decisions that members of Congress and the president certainly need to make constantly about war, about the economy, about my family's survival, about my children's children, all that thing. So it's very important. But you could also be put to sleep with politics. You could also be, if you look at what's going on in Washington and see all the things that are not working, you can just, you know, hang your head and say, this is just, you know, hopeless. I try to put a little context to it, reminding people of what it used to be like in the good old days, even though the good old days probably wasn't that so good anyway. But also just talk about, try to make it lighthearted, try to make it fun, and how it affects people and how it touches people individually, even though people seem so far removed from what's going on in Washington.
Because I think if you just cover the ups and downs and the polls, and that gets a little boring after a while.
Not only does it get boring, we get a lot of criticism on public radio about that as well. Say, this is not about horse race. It's about who's going to change my life, who's going to change the tax equity in this country, who's going to change foreign policy in this country. So, yes, I am a winner-loser polling person. I am a political junkie. But at the same time, I do know what people care about, and that really is much more than just, you know, who's up and who's down.
And knowing the ups and downs from one race to another teaches you about the overall trends in politics.
Not only that, also it's important to know what we've seen before, what's come before this time, to say that, well, I've never seen this before. And that's not true. We saw that in the 84 election. We saw that in the 52 election. So sometimes you need that kind of context to realize that that everything we've seen, that it does have parallels in previous lives.
When did you start doing the trivia questions?
Well, what happened is I started writing, even while I was at NPR, in 1998, I started writing a political junkie column on the web. And after several years, it came over to NPR. And Talk of the Nation decided that I would be a frequent / infrequent guest at Talk of the Nation with Neil Conan. And we just do a little politics wrap and, you know, if there would be a confirmation hearing or some major candidate dropped out or something like that. And then we decided, well, let's have fun with it. Let's have a trivia question every day. And what I try to do with the trivia question is I don't want to come up with something that you could easily look up in Google or Wikipedia or something like that. You have to have some kind of understanding of what politics is all about to get the answer. Not everybody understands it as well as they would like. And I get emails from all over the country, all over the world, in fact, saying, I still have not able to answer these questions. But I think people like, I think it makes people think. And I think that's what makes politics fun.
How do you come up with your trivia questions?
Well, a lot of it has to do with, you know, the news of the week, for example. So the question this week, Mitt Romney, in some counts, officially captured the Republican nomination, got enough delegates to capture the Republican nomination. But who was he? So I'm thinking, well, but who did it earliest in history? I mean, a lot of times we know that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama went on until late May, early June, battling out for the Democratic nomination. So my question this week was, what non-incumbent Republican won it the earliest? Now, if you know anything about politics, you know that in latter days, when the primaries are coming earlier and earlier, like, for example, in 2008, a lot of the primaries were in January. So a lot of people were guessing, was it Lincoln? Was it Nixon? Was it Eisenhower? No, obviously, with early primaries, you have an opportunity to win the nomination early. So the answer was John McCain just 4 years ago. So sometimes you have to have an understanding of what the politics at stake, and then you can get the answer pretty easily.
Have you ever had a trivia question that no one got the right answer for?
Well, last week was one of them, but sometimes you do. I don't try to do like, you know, who was the tallest, who was the first, this or that, because then you could always look it up. But I always like sometimes if it's the NCAA basketball tournament, I try to do a sports related thing, or if it's a World Series related thing, I'll try to put sports in it, because a lot of people I found, and I'm part of this group, that people who love baseball and sports and stats and things like that often like politics as well. It's not a man thing. It's just a thing, but it's something, you know, you love to talk about the good old days or the bad old days. And it's true about sports. It's true about politics.
If you're just joining us, I'm WRVO's Catherine Loper, and you're listening to a conversation with Ken Bruden, NPR's political junkie. And we've just been talking about his trivia questions, and I want to move on to the famous button collection. How many buttons do you have?
Well, I have 70,000 campaign buttons. I started collecting in 1966, when I was only 6 months old. And I remember at the end of the 66 campaign, I would write to all the candidates. I'd write to George Wallace and George Romney and Nelson Rockefeller. I grew up in a small town in New York called the Bronx. And I would write to all these candidates. And at the end of the election cycle in 66, I had a shoebox filled. I said, I can't believe I have so many great buttons. And now it's 70,000. It's presidential from 1896 to the present, from Alabama through Wyoming, for governor, senator, Congress, big city mayor, Vietnam, civil rights, rock and roll, sports. I'm very lonely is really what it comes down to. It's sad.
I doubt that. But one of our listeners tweeted in a question prior to the broadcast, and she wanted to know, and I want to know, how do you store all those buttons?
Well, I mean, everybody thinks that they're going to come into my house and see it all on the walls. It's really not. It's really almost like a library. It's construction paper stapled to artboard in file folders in bookcases. So if you're looking at it, all you're seeing are bookcases. You just have to know where to go to get. And obviously, when I write a political junkie column on NPR.org, and I use the campaign buttons to illustrate the campaigns I'm talking about. So obviously I know I need to know how to find them immediately if I'm going to illustrate those buttons.
Do you have a few favorites on display?
Not on display, but I do have some favorites. I mean, there's a famous button, a picture of Lyndon Johnson in 1965, right after he got his gallbladder surgery, gallbladder removed. He famously showed his scar to journalists. Well, there's this great button put out in around 1967 with a picture of Lyndon Johnson. He's lifting up his shirt, but the scar is in the shape of Vietnam. So, you know, kind of says a lot of things there. So, and I mean, in later years, the buttons were more coarse during Clinton, and especially Clinton, but also during Bush and Obama. Some of them are just awful. Some of them are tasteless. Some of them are crass. In the old days, they were kind of clever. When Wendell Willkie was trying to stop Franklin Roosevelt's third term in 1940, one of the buttons said, "No third termites." You know, I mean, they were kind of things that were not as just silly and juvenile as they are today.
Well, buttons really used to serve a purpose of advertising. But our listener tweeted in, has the significance of buttons changed in this modern, you know, climate?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, most campaigns don't supply buttons anymore. In the old days, you can walk into a campaign headquarters and just fill your pockets or just take two and walk out. Most of them are done by independent jobbers. Most of them are ordered online. And for the most part, campaign buttons are really for collectors only. They're not really worn. Like in the old days, the I Like Ike buttons were big in 52. The G. McCarthy peace lapel peace sign in 1968 were big. But for the most part, they're for collectors by collectors, and they don't serve the purpose that they used to because now you have 24/7 consultants and television advertising, and that's where the real money goes.
And every week you do a scuttle button puzzle for NPR. First of all, why is it called scuttle button?
Well, we had to come up with a name for it. And for example, it's hard to explain what it is, but it's a rebus. I put three or four buttons in a vertical line, and you have to take one word per button, come out with a slogan. So in other words, if I had a Feinstein for Senate button, and I had a Perot for President button, and then I have two Supreme Court Justice buttons on the bottom, like impeachable Warren and whatever it is. So if you add the Feinstein for Senate, the Perot for President, and the two Supreme Court buttons, you have Diane Ross and the Supremes.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I'm not very good
at
them.
I'm not sure if it translates on radio, but so it's a lot of fun. Anyway, every week on the website, there's a button puzzle as well.
I want to note there will be a local trivia question and a scuttle button question at tonight's event.
And
Syracuse
a Talk of the Nation t-shirt for the prize.
For the prize winner. This is tonight at the Syracuse stage event. So we'll get some local Ken Rudin puzzlers there. And if you're not familiar with the scuttle button puzzle or the trivia question, you can always go to npr.org/junkie and get his scuttle button puzzles there and read his political junkie column as well. Do you get a lot of feedback on the buttons and the puzzles? I mean, do people give you suggestions?
Oh, not only that, but I get people from former members of Congress or former lawmakers, you know, people in office say, you know, I've been trying to enter your contest for the longest time. I have people who have run for the Senate, former members of the House. I just remember just a lot of times I'll appear at an event wearing the buttons of their, not only of the people I'm supposed to be meeting with, but their opponent that they defeated for election 20 years prior. So they love talking about their own political history. And the fact that I have buttons from their opponent of 20 years prior, they just open up. Quick story. I don't know if we have time for a quick story. Tom Ridge, when he was in charge of Homeland Security at NPR, he came to NPR one day, and he's very gruff, and he's not smiling, and he's talking about rah, 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 and, you know, everybody's asking him a question. He's giving the obligatory answers, but he keeps looking at his watch because he had to meet with President Bush at the White House. As he's finishing his presentation, I said, Mr. Secretary, before you go, I'd like to show you my Tom Ridge button collection. I had about 150 Tom Ridge when he was governor of Pennsylvania. He stayed there for a half hour, and all his aides said, "We're late for the White House." He said, "Forget about it. No, don't worry about that." And he said, "Oh, I remember that one. Oh, I can't remember that one. I remember that one." A lot of times they love to look at their own history because that's what campaign buttons really are. It's just a remembrance of a whole political career. It's a lot of fun.
And candidates really remember their early
races. They do. Winning or losing, absolutely.
Well, that's quite a compliment to keep the president waiting for your button collection. We're going to take a quick break here. We'll continue our conversation with Ken Rudin in just a few moments. I'm WRVO's Catherine Loper.
Q presents important names, big ideas, and those paving the way in the cultural community. Hi, I'm Gian Gomeshi, the host of Q, your daily look at arts, entertainment, and cultural affairs. Join me each weeknight as we talk about art, music, people, and dive into provocative and compelling cultural trends. Hear Q every weeknight at 9, beginning June 18th on WRVO.
I'm WRVO's Catherine Loper. Today, WRVO is being joined by NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin, and he joins me here in studio. And we are also now joined by SUNY Oswego political science professor and regular guest here on WRVO, Bruce Altshuler. Bruce, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure to be on.
Terrific. So let's turn now to this election year. Presidential campaigns are what those of us who love politics live for. So let's start with that marquee event of 2012, the presidential race. Of course, this is a re-election year. It's different from 2008, which was an open election. So first, let's start with the primary season. Mitt Romney, just secured enough delegates to go over the top to be the nominee. What lessons do you think we learned from his journey through the primary season? Bruce, do you want to
start? Well, I think one of the things we learned, I don't know if learned is the right word because we probably knew it already, was money really talks. The super PACs, particularly in the early primaries, cemented the nomination for him because conservatives basically said, we will vote for some other credible candidate instead of Mitt Romney. And they tried everybody, and they were destroyed in the primaries largely through negative advertising. They were flawed candidates to start with. And so in that sense, money really talked this year.
But at the same time, if you look at the history of the Republican Party, they seem to always reward the one who tried and failed in the past and came back for a second time. We saw that with Ronald Reagan. He got the nomination in 1980, having lost in 76. We saw that with Bob Dole in 96, having lost the nomination earlier. George H.W. Bush, John McCain. So it seems to be often on the Republican side that they're rewarding. It's now their turn. But Bruce is absolutely right. Romney had the money. Romney had the establishment backing. And in a truncated primary where there's so much, one after another, with such negative ads, money does make a difference.
And it seemed like there was always a different conservative candidate on top through the primary season.
It was the front runner of the week. I mean, it was the anybody but Romney crowd. So first it was Michelle Bachmann, then it was Rick Perry, and then it was Herman Cain. Explain to me how Herman Cain would be the front runner, but there was such dissatisfaction among the Republican base with Mitt Romney that they were trying to look at anybody. Then it was Newt Gingrich. Actually, it was Newt Gingrich several times until he self-destructed or Romney helped self-destruct him. And the one person who was not a front runner was Rick Santorum, and he's the one who lasted the longest.
And how did those battles with those different candidates change Romney or shape Romney as a candidate, Bruce?
I think they certainly made him a more effective campaigner. One of the things you saw if you watched the debates was he started out with some very poor performances. And by the end, he got much better. He's still very prone to gaffes. He tends to say things that are very quotable by his opponents. But as a candidate, he's gotten to be a more effective candidate. It highlighted some of his flaws, but they seem to be less of a problem now that the general election period is approaching than I think most people thought at the time.
And a lot of Republicans would certainly point to things that Romney said in the past when he was a more moderate candidate, when he ran against Ted Kennedy for the Senate in Massachusetts in 1994, when he ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2002. He was certainly more moderate on social issues like abortion, like same-sex marriage, things like that. And, of course, there was the element of flip-flopping, the charge that was out there that was also directed at John Kerry back in 2004. And it was directed against Mitt Romney, but for President Obama, who flip-flopped on same-sex marriage, I mean, every candidate has to adjust to in order to accomplish what they need to accomplish, and that's victory. And Romney seems to have weathered that storm pretty well.
It was sort of a practice for the attacks that'll come from President Obama.
Oh, they're coming, and then there's plenty of attacks coming from the Romney camp as well, aimed at the president as well.
And let's turn to the president. He, of course, did not have a major primary opponent, but we did see a couple of races, primary states recently, Kentucky and Arkansas, West Virginia, where 40% or more of the Democratic primary voters did not vote for him. Does this say anything, or were those states just outliers?
Well, see, this is pretty remarkable because, I mean, he was not opposed. I mean, he ran unopposed. And the fact that somebody who is in prison in Texas got 40% of the vote in West Virginia, the fact that somebody else, that uncommitted, got 40% of the vote in Kentucky. Look, President Obama is not going to win Kentucky, Arkansas, West Virginia. These states are clearly Republican states for November. But the fact that within his own party, he could barely get 60% of the vote. In some of these states, there's a lot of people who just have not warmed up to the president. And as popular as he may have been in 2008, he's going to have to double his efforts in 2012 if he's going to try to reunite that spark that he had 4 years ago.
And Bruce, how would you describe this sort of current state of play in the race between Obama and Romney?
It seems to me most of the votes are set already. Even at this early stage, you got about 40 to 45% of the voters who are so anti-Obama they will vote for whoever the Republicans put up. And probably about 40 or 45% of the voters who are sure Obama voters. So what we're going to see is this concentration on this other 15 to 20% of the voters, whether it's in swing states, whether it's independents. The question is going to be, can you turn out your base Can Obama, for instance, reconstruct that enthusiasm among younger voters and Latinos particularly to get them to come to the polls? Or should he concentrate on those independent voters, that relatively smaller group now? I think that's going to be one of the big questions.
And Ken Rudin, what do you think the biggest challenges are for Obama and Romney?
Well, I agree with Bruce completely, but I think the key there is swing states. Forget about New York, forget about California, forget about Texas. The presidential race will not be run in those states, even though there are so many voters. It will be in the Virginias, North Carolinas, Indiana, Florida, Ohio, New Mexico states where it's just so close that it could go either way. And even though there's so few votes, relatively few votes in a New Mexico or a New Hampshire, the fact that it could go either way means tons and tons of money and outside money will go into those states.
What are the biggest swing states you're watching this year?
Well, just what I was saying, I mean, a lot of them are states that Republicans are used to winning, like George W. Bush won in 2004, that Barack Obama took in 2008, like Florida, like Ohio, like Virginia, like North Carolina. Now, Indiana, I don't think is in play anymore. I think that's back to the Republican roots. But a lot of the states that have gone Republican, but with a large African-American population, with a large state, population of new voters coming to the state, those are the ones you have to watch. And look, we always know that no Republican has ever been elected president without winning Ohio. Romney's going to have to pick up at least two or three, if not more, of those Obama states from 08 back to the Republican fold if he's going to win in November.
And Florida, did we talk about Florida?
Florida is tough. It's dead even. I mean, some people say, well, the reason he should pick, Romney should pick Marco Rubio as his running mate, it helps him with Latino voters, and the Republicans are really, really doing poorly with Latino voters. It'll help him with Florida. Maybe yes, maybe no, but Florida is a big one. Obviously, if Al Gore got 500 more votes than George W. Bush in 2000, Al Gore would have been president. So Florida, I think Florida and Ohio are the two states to watch the closest.
Pennsylvania is probably the closest swing state to New York or New Hampshire. What do you think are the issues for those two swing states?
Well, Pennsylvania hasn't gone for a Republican candidate since 1988. But having said that, we have seen a big swing towards the Republicans in 2010. They captured both houses of the state legislature. They elected a Republican governor, Tom Corbett. They elected a Republican senator to replace Arlen Specter, who I don't know really what party Arlen Specter was. I think he was the Arlen Specter party. But anyway, it was a big Republican year in Pennsylvania. And the question is, and we see that with congressional races as well. We saw big Democratic gains in 2006, 2008 that were completely reversed in 2010. The question is, what message will 2012 give you? Will it be another reversal or will it be an affirmation of what we saw 2 years ago?
The state I'd suggest people take a look at, because it's going to have a test very soon, is Wisconsin. Wisconsin is certainly one of the swing states. It's not one that's gone traditionally Republican, but it did in 2010 elect the famous or infamous, depending on which side you're on, Scott Walker as governor, and he's subject to a recall election.
On Tuesday.
Which is happening now. So that's going to be our very first clue as to what's going on.
In that state, yeah. In that important state of Wisconsin. If you're just joining us, I'm WRVO's Catherine Loper, and you're listening to a conversation with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. And we're also joined by SUNY Oswego political science professor Bruce Altshuler. Bruce, let's turn to the issues of the presidential race. Economy is the predominant issue. It hasn't improved as much as probably anyone, including President Obama, would want since he was elected president. What do you think the president needs to do with this economy in the backdrop?
Presidential elections are framed in ways that are either helpful or not helpful to incumbents. And what the Republicans want to do is make this a referendum on the economy, because that doesn't look very good, barring some dramatic improvement. What President Obama wants to do is make this a contest between two competing philosophies of economic improvement, and he's going to argue that the philosophy Romney is advocating is the one that got us into this mess under President Bush. So Romney's going to say time for a change. Obama is going to say don't put us back to where we were before.
And what does Romney have to do on the economy to get his message heard?
Well, all Romney has to do is just point to rising gas prices. Now, gas prices are not rising. They seem to be coming down a little bit. Now, I don't think the Republicans are going to complain about that, but obviously it doesn't fit with their message. But Bruce is exactly right. If this is about the past 4 years, President Obama is in big, big trouble, because you have to, you know, no president, I think, since FDR has been elected, reelected with unemployment this high. But at the same time, if he can point to what Mitt Romney may or may not have done at Bain Capital, for example, what he and his advisors and Paul Ryan, the House Budget Committee chairman, what they're proposing regarding Medicare and Social Security and entitlement programs, if what they're proposing, what the Republicans are proposing are far worse, then Obama could say, well, look, things are not perfect, but they'll certainly be far better under four more years of my rule administration than they would be with the Republicans.
What about this attack by the Democrats on Romney's role with Bain Capital? How's that playing? How's that going to play going forward?
Well, I don't think the Democrats got the kind of the mileage out of it that they would have liked. But of course, if you're Mitt Romney and you make the case that I have this expertise as a businessman and that's the stuff I will bring into the White House, and if Bain Capital has a history of buying and eating up companies and spitting them out, which is what the Obama campaign is trying to portray them in, then it's fair game. But at the same time, private equity is responsible for a lot of urban growth in this country. It's not all about, look, it's not all about job creation, but it's not vampire capitalism as many of the Obama ads are trying to portray it as. So not every Democrat feels that that's the right way to go after the Republicans. But again, if the economy, if business is Romney's strong suit, then I think Bain Capital is fair game.
I think there's also a trap for President Obama in the sense that he's run as a corporate-friendly Democrat. He has not prosecuted any of the Wall Street firms for the events that occurred during the last administration and running into his. He's been soliciting money from Wall Street, at least until the recent J.P. Morgan Chase misadventure. He had been touting Jamie Dimon as a leader to be emulated by other banks. So his problem is he suddenly seems to be shifting gears from being a relatively business-friendly Democrat, whatever the Republicans might say, as a socialist, to being suddenly a more populist Democrat. And that's going to be a question. Can he keep that balance? Will he be able to do that?
And Democrats for years have been yelling out of frustration at the Obama administration for being so pro-business. What about the change and the hope that we voted for in 2008? Obviously, it wasn't working under Bush, and to have Bush light, as some Democrats were calling Obama, in the White House, that was not what they wanted. So for many progressives, they wanted the gloves to come off. They wanted an all-out assault on Wall Street. That, of course, is not what Obama's been doing the last 4 years.
Foreign policy can prove either positive or, you know, if there's a foreign policy surprise during election year, can be a negative for incumbent candidates. How do you think this is going to work for President Obama? He's been touting that, you know, Osama bin Laden's no longer with us. That is a success for him. How do you think foreign policy is going to affect this race?
I agree with Bruce completely in the sense that this is about the economy. There are people who are watching what's going on overseas. But at the same time, for President Obama to say, I want to take credit for what happened with Gaddafi in Libya, what about what's going on in Syria with the massacres of thousands of people and nothing is done there? Now, I don't think Republicans are talking about let's invade Syria, just like they were saying we don't need to invade Libya either. But the point is, there are a lot of things that the president promised 4 years ago. We thought we'd be out of Afghanistan by now. We thought Guantanamo would be closed by now. There are a lot of issues that President Obama ran on and made promises for that have not held up. He's not held up that part of the bargain. But ultimately, again, it will be the pocketbook. It will be my financial future, my family's financial future, and less so about. But of course, as you say, there's always a possibility of an October surprise, like, let's not even come up with ideas right here, but let's a surprise that could either strengthen Obama's case or put further worry in the minds of American voters.
And an October surprise could be something economic, you know, something that happens, gas prices go up or down or whatever. What other issues, Bruce, do you think will be the important ones coming up in the general election?
Well, there are a number of issues that are potential wild card issues. Immigration is one, for instance. The Republicans in the primaries took a very hard pro-enforcement position. The difficulty for that for them is that very appealing to the Republican base. Polls indicate it's a popular position with the majority of the population, but it's an extremely unpopular position with Latino voters who are particularly likely to vote on that basis. With that said, however, President Obama has not been effective in getting his immigration policies passed, not even the DREAM Act. And he's had more deportations than President Bush had in a comparable period. So both sides have a problem. Can Romney move to a more moderate-seeming position? For instance, if he put Marco Rubio on the ticket, Marco Rubio is in favor of a slightly weaker version of the DREAM Act. Can he get support? I think the numbers indicate that the key in the Latino vote is about 40%. If Mitt Romney can get 40% or better of the Latino vote, he's likely to win.
But Bruce, how many Republicans in history have gotten 40% of
Bush.
The – Bush is the only one.
Bush, yeah.
So, I mean, 40% is a big number to worry about.
But that's because the Latino vote is much larger than it used to be. And that's the other question. What will the turnout be? Will President Obama get a large slice of a smaller segment or not? But if Romney gets under 35% of the Latino vote, I think he's cooked.
What about race? I mean, I'm raising this question, and only because I don't know what the answer is to that. You look at the results in the Democratic primaries in Arkansas, West Virginia, Kentucky, and a lot of people say, well, it's because Obama's black. But Obama was still black in 2008, and he won a lot of white parts of this country. How big of a role do you think race plays in this election?
Well, that's a good question, because most people don't want to talk about it. President Obama doesn't want to talk about it. Every time he does, as we saw in the Skip Gates arrest controversy and the Beer Summit, for example, there's a backlash on it. The Republicans certainly don't want to talk about it. And so what you get is a lot of code. And the question is, how subtle is some of that code? The whole birther question often seems to relate very much to race. And you could see what a problem that is every time that Mitt Romney gets near Donald Trump, for example, or the Secretary of State in Arizona threatens to take Barack Obama off the ballot. So I think that's one of those issues where we're not going to know.
In fairness, David Patterson, the former governor, was – that's how old I am. I talk about Basil Patterson, his father. David Patterson said a few days ago, even if he wasn't born in this country – I can't believe David Patterson said this. Even if he wasn't born in this country –
he'd probably still be a citizen.
He's getting away with – he's gotten away with it so far. I mean, nobody should be talking about this.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we'll have to take a quick break here, but we'll continue our conversation with Ken Rudin in just a few moments. I'm WRVO's Catherine Loper.
Hi, I'm Brent Bambury, host of Day 6, a new program from the CBC and Public Radio International. Day 6 will give you something to think about, talk about, maybe even to laugh about. Get a different perspective on the biggest stories going with Day 6, Saturdays at 2, beginning June 23rd on WRVO Public Media.
If you're just joining us, I'm WRVO's Catherine Loper, and you're listening to a conversation with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. And also joining us in studio is SUNY Oswego political science professor Bruce Altshuler. I want to turn now to New York state politics. Let's first start with the governor, Andrew Cuomo. Quinnipiac came out with a poll this week showing he has a very high approval rating, 71%. Ken, what do you think his prospects are for future positions?
Well, you know, unless your name is Malcolm Wilson, if you're the governor of New York, you're a presidential prospect and you have no choice in the matter. I think Malcolm Wilson was the only one who said, look, let's be real here. But Andrew Cuomo could be just like his dad, too. I mean, to this day, I still remember people waiting in Concord, New Hampshire, at the filing deadline for the New Hampshire primary, waiting for Mario Cuomo to give the okay. Mario Cuomo was a great orator. Andrew Cuomo may not be a great orator, but he's certainly one of the most popular governors in the country. He's popular with Republicans as well. And so, you know, I mean, the other day I was just reading that, will Andrew Cuomo challenge Hillary Clinton for 2016? I know. We haven't gotten to 2012 yet. But anyway, the point is, I think he does have a very clear path
to whatever he wants to do, assuming he maintains that popularity.
And Bruce, what do you think about Cuomo's record, helps or hurts him for future
positions? Well, Cuomo is what I like to call the last moderate Republican in the United States. And in that sense, he's worked actually better with the state Senate's majority Republicans than with the majority Assembly Democrats and Sheldon Silver on things like the property tax cap. What you always have to remember in politics is nobody maintains those kind of popularity ratings. So if we're talking about 2016, we're talking about a time frame in which Andrew Cuomo will no doubt be considerably less popular. He's accomplished pretty much all he wanted to achieve already. So what's he going to do for the next couple of – for the next 4 years here? What will happen when he runs for re-election, which is clearly going to happen before the 2016 election? Will he hold that popularity?
And that's a very good point, because if you go – just go back 4 years ago to right now, the most popular governor in the country was a woman by the name of Sarah Palin, had astronomical numbers in Alaska, and then, of course – we know what happened after that.
And remember, also, Andrew Cuomo's father was extremely popular. Yeah, he was the Hamlet on the Hudson in terms of decisiveness, so to speak. And what tends to happen is some negative characteristic will appear. Some problem will occur. He's had a lot of very centralized power in New York State, and that works well for a while. But soon people talk about a lack of transparency, for example.
It's all about timing in politics, isn't it? Let's turn to the local congressional races. There are three really interesting ones in our listening region. First, we've got incumbent Republican Anne-Marie Burkle. She's running against the former congressman, which she ousted last time, Dan Maffei. Bruce, how do you see this race shaping up?
Potentially a very close race. Maffei is a prolific fundraiser. That's his strongest point. He's not the most charismatic orator. I think she's viewed as a very conservative Republican, one of the most conservative Republicans running in the most liberal state in the country. With that said, redistricting is going to help her a bit. Some of the early redistricting plans were very unfavorable to her, but the one that she got added a big chunk of Oswego County, which is an area that's been pretty Republican. And so that looks like a very close, and it's going to be a very fierce race. Both parties have targeted it. So it's going to be very high profile. Expect to hear, not on RVO, happily, expect to hear and see a lot of negative ads.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce, you make a very good point. And yes, she is very conservative, running in a very liberal state, but she's not running statewide. She's running in a historically Republican district. And so maybe that helps her. But for all the talk, we don't have to worry about it. Nobody talks about what role New York will play in the presidential race. But in the battle for Congress, you have seven Republicans in office in the congressional delegation in New York State. And a lot of them, most of them, were elected for the first time in 2010 in that big Republican wave. The question is, if this is a correction from 2010, if the 2012 election is a correction of 2010, then you could see a lot of candidates, especially Burkle, in big trouble. But if the Democrats are going to win back control of the House, and I don't think they do, they need 25 seats. But if they do, they're going to have to start upstate New York.
Although two New York seats are disappearing, so the seat that the Democrats lost that used to be the Anthony Weiner seat, for example, is going to be gone. They can't recapture it.
And Maurice Hinchey is gone, too.
Yeah.
One of our listeners put on Facebook a question, and he wanted to know about how moderate congressional candidates, some of them are being what he called primaried by the more conservative candidates. And we've got an example. Richard Hanna faces a primary challenge. How do you think you see this playing out, both in New York and across the nation?
Well, it's not an encouraging sign if you believe in one party talking to the other party. Richard Hanna seems to do that more than most Republicans elected in 2010. And the fact is that there is a desire for purity, ideological purity, both on the Democratic side, on the Republican side. We saw the Tea Party coming in 2010, not only defeating scores of Democrats, but also beating back moderate Republicans like Mike Castle in Delaware, like candidates in Colorado and Nevada. Perhaps that's the reason the Republicans didn't win the seat, because they nominated very, very conservative candidates. But at the same time, the Republicans wouldn't control the House if it weren't for the Tea Party. They brought an enthusiasm, they brought a vigor that you didn't have. You certainly didn't have it under President Bush, because a lot of Republicans were on the defensive. Perhaps the best thing that could have happened to the Tea Party was the election of Barack Obama in 2008, because it was an easy target, somebody to put in your sights.
But we also saw the same problem in some of the other districts we're going to talk about, particularly the Bill Owens district, which is a district the Democrats hadn't captured for close to 100 years. And the only reason they captured and retained it was because of divisions with the Republican Party between those candidates who were conservative versus those candidates who were very conservative.
That's a good example. And what do you think about Owens' chances this year? His district has changed in because of redistricting as well.
He's really hurt himself in the last couple of weeks by this issue of travel, where he seems to have taken some travel funds, perhaps from lobbyists that he shouldn't have, and he's now going to have to repay them. I'm sure we're going to see a lot of negative ads about that, and I think that's really hurt him.
Redistricting, we mentioned. How is that, Ken, affecting races across the country? Everyone's going through redistricting. One of our listeners wrote in wanting to know about this. He called redistricting a big mess.
Well, obviously, if you control the process, if you control the state legislature, and if you control and you have the governorship, you're able to control redistricting in the states that allows partisan redistricting. In California, for example, it's an independent commission completely devoid of political pressures. So you can have a tremendous turnover in California. Both Democrats and Republicans will go down to defeat. But in New York, it's split because you have a Democratic governor, you have a Republican state senate. So the Republicans do have a say at the table. In Ohio, for example, it's all Republican and Democrats are suffering. In Illinois, it's all Democratic and Republicans are suffering. So ultimately, it may be a net gain of one or two seats for the Republicans, but the more important thing is that Republicans have been able to redraw the lines to cement the gains they made in 2010. So they may not, the goal with redistricting in 2012 may not be to pick up new seats, but is to keep those they elected in 2010, make them a little safer.
In case you're just joining us, we are having a conversation with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, and we are also joined by Bruce Altshuler, a political science professor here at SUNY Oswego. Ken, you mentioned if the Republicans want to keep the House, that starts here in New York. How are Dems doing on holding on to the Senate?
Well, it numerically, it's tough. There are 33 Senate seats up in 2012. 23 of them are held by the Democrats. But we have seen some changes. So basically, the Republicans need a net gain of 4 seats to take control of the Senate. And numerically, that doesn't seem like a tough battle. But there have been some trends lately that may be helping the Democrats. Olympia Snow, the very moderate and very popular senator from Republican from Maine, decided to retire. That seat is gone for the Republicans. Probably an independent-leaning Democrat will take that seat. In Indiana, we don't know what's going to happen, but Richard Lugar, an unbeatable Republican who's been around since 1066. Not many people know that. He's been around that long. No, he was first elected in 1976, seeking a seventh term, and he was knocked out by a very conservative Tea Party Richard Murdoch challenger in the primary. So Democrats are hopeful about that seat, too. But again, a lot and you could say, well, maybe a lot has to do with the presidential race. Not always, because when Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992, Republicans picked up seats in the House. When George H.W. Bush was elected president in 1988, Democrats picked up seats in the House. So it doesn't always mean that whoever's going to win the presidency is going to win local downstate races, ballot races.
I think Republicans have some real hopes of gaining. There have been a couple of Democrats who were retiring. I think most notably in Nebraska, Ben Nelson, a very conservative Democrat who's retiring. And Republicans are a strong favorite to recapture that seat. Bob Kerry, not to be confused with John Kerry spelled differently, actually had to move from New York back to Nebraska to run for what was his old Senate seat, and that he doesn't seem to be appealing that well to Nebraska.
So you don't think that living in Greenwich Village for 11 years helps you win in Nebraska?
Well, he was a college president, and I kind of like that, but probably not.
Ken, do you have any other favorite races you're watching across the country, either House or Senate?
Well, you know, of course, as Bruce says, the retirements are big and that's significant in Virginia. Georgia, you have two former governors and George Allen against Tim Kaine. That's an ultimate referendum on President Obama. You have Tim Kaine, the Democratic nominee, former governor, who is President Obama's choice to be Democratic National Committee chairman, against George Allen, who was basically measuring the drapes for the White House until he came up with his macaca comment in 2006. And that seemed that it was the end of his career. career at that time. This is for the seat that Jim Webb is leaving, and it's a very, very tight race. And Bruce is also right about Wisconsin. Yes, the gubernatorial recall is in on Tuesday, and while the Democrats are always favored to win in Wisconsin in the presidential race, you have Herb Kohl leaving that Senate seat there, a very close race for that Senate seat. Tammy Baldwin, the first, if she's elected, she'll be the first openly lesbian candidate elected to the Senate, and the Democrat and the Republicans are fighting each other over who's a true conservative. That's another seat to watch.
We didn't talk about Veep stakes before, but senators and governors are traditionally where VP candidates are drawn from. Who do you see out there as being a potential Romney VP?
Well, I'm always wrong. 4 years ago, I was convinced it was Tim Pawlenty for McCain. I still think it's going to be Rob Portman, the not exciting, but very competent and solid senator from Ohio. His problems with him is that he was George Bush's budget director, and the Democrats are not going to let us forget that. But again, in a time when I don't think Mitt Romney has to do a Hail Mary as John McCain did with Sarah Palin, I think Romney being an even race, I don't think he wants to upset the apple cart at all. Portman could take over as president if the worst happened, and I think Portman would be a solid choice.
Bruce?
I think Romney has three strategies he can try, and that's why I'd look at it. One is the strategy of trying to expand the base a bit, and that would likely mean a Latino candidate. Marco Rubio or Susana Martinez, who's the governor of New Mexico, would be possibilities there. A second option would be to go for somebody somewhat similar to Romney who would be seen as a capable manager, wouldn't hurt the ticket. That's where Portman would come in as a possibility. The third would be double down. Double down on the Republican economic program and go for a Paul Ryan. That would be the one that would probably energize the Republican base a lot, but it would be probably the least safe choice.
Mm-hmm. Campaign finance has gotten a lot of attention. You mentioned money in the primaries, Bruce. Let's talk about super PACs for a moment. I think most people are familiar with this term, but that's been a new thing this campaign cycle that's put a different sort of spin on the way the campaigns are run. Ken, what do you think the effect's been?
Well, they certainly helped nominate Mitt Romney, because while Mitt Romney did not openly attack his opponents with the advertising and television, his super PACs aligned with him, basically decimated Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, and for a while Rick Perry from the beginning. To talk about money in politics is not new. 4 years ago, Barack Obama had spent and raised $750 million. He outspent John McCain 3-1. So it's not that money to politics is new, but this independent super PACs where you don't have to know who's giving money to what, that's the real objection I have. I think a lot of money is not criminal in politics, but not knowing who's paying for it, where it's coming from, that's disturbing. And but is it a big issue? I don't think so. I mean, I don't think voters will go to the polls complaining about money in politics.
Or is it an issue, the unlimited amount of money from individuals?
Well, that's been the big change. In 2008, the candidates pretty much stuck to the limit on contributions. I think it was $2,400 that year. It's $2,500 this time, because McCain discouraged independent expenditures on philosophical grounds. He was a reformer and didn't like that. Obama discouraged independent expenditures because he'd raised so much money, he preferred to keep control of the spending. It's changed this time, and you have these very wealthy people who can be complete wild cards. People may have noticed the proposal about a week or two ago by a wealthy Republican to have independent expenditures resurrecting the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And people went ballistic, and Romney basically said, please don't do that. And that gentleman has withdrawn that. So some of these super PACs can go off in some way that the candidates may not like. And that's going to be interesting to see how independent they really are here. And will a Sheldon Adelson, to take one person who's already given $20 million largely to Newt Gingrich this time, or another wealthy individual, suddenly start his own or her own advertising campaign and change the dynamic of the election single-handedly, perhaps for the worse for their candidate?
Ken Rudin, we're closing in on the end of our hour here, but what are the few key things you think our listeners should pay attention to this election cycle?
Well, I think obviously the choice of a running mate, I think, first of all, I think it's always often overstated. And except for Lyndon Johnson in 1960, for the most part, it doesn't win or lose you an election. Geraldine Ferraro, how exciting that was. And Mondale Ferraro lost 49 states. So that doesn't always make a big difference. But it will send a signal to the rest of the party and the rest of the country how Mitt Romney wants to govern. If he does the safe pick, a Pawlenty type, a Rob Portman type, it'll show that he's very serious about governing, less ideological.
I want to really thank you all for listening to our conversation with NPR's Ken Rudin. Ken, I want to thank you so much for joining us, as well as WRVO's own political junkie, political science professor Bruce Altshuler. And I want to remind our listeners that tickets are still available for tonight's public events at Syracuse Stage to see Ken Rudin. Tickets range from $15 to $20 and are available at the door. Ken and Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine.
Pleasure.
Today's audio engineer is Jason Smith, and we've had additional support from Leah Landry. Thanks for listening. I'm WRVO's Catherine Loper. This beautiful land, and take over this beautiful land.